by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass makes heaven in the middle of it. Grass makes heaven in the middle. We are grass makes
secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. This second hour is going to be coming to you from recordings that we made at the Oswald Conference, okay? And this was last weekend in New Orleans at the Crowne Plaza Airport, New Orleans. And it was produced by Trine Day Publishing, which was founded by Chris Milligan. And it was just a really fine three-day conference. Randall Mock and I went down for the Saturday and Sunday conference. We took some equipment down there that was helpful to them doing, especially some of the panel discussions. So we got to watch and listen to most of all the Saturday and Sunday day speakers, which amounted to about 15, 20 speakers. And so what I did was after Roger Stone spoke for about 30 minutes or so, 34 minutes, and then I recorded that. And then also, I had about a 10-minute interview out in the lobby with him. Actually, he spoke for about 24 minutes, and then I had a 10-minute interview. So there's about 34 minutes of this hour number two that originated from Oswald Conference. And then I'm going to be making some comments here at the beginning, and then I'll frontly come in and set up the difference between his speaking to the audience there, and then my little interview with him after he spoke to the audience. But it's Oswald Conference. This is the third annual conference. Oh, by the way, you can come in to thesecrettruth.com, and you can listen to our programs on demand, you know, on that website. You'll see that the date. It'll be October 22nd, 2016, and we broadcast on Saturday evenings. Here from Austin, Texas. We've been broadcasting for 10 years. Charlotte Littlefield and myself, on November 1, it will be our anniversary, our 10th anniversary of the Secret Truth radio broadcast program. And over that period, we've interviewed probably over 500 people, different authors and so forth. We've originated some of the programs when we're out on the road backing up Ron Paul and so forth. So we have a plethora of differing programs there. And we have some rebroadcasts that we've done in the last few years and some live. So there's a mixture that we're doing now. These two programs are going to be, they were originated live, but they're not, neither one is a rebroadcast. So it's both these hours tonight are fresh programs. The Oswald Conference is very unusual in the sense that 2 years ago I went down and did the first one and missed the second year, and then I went back on this third year one. But Judith Ferry Baker has been a big mover shaker in getting that done, along with Chris Milligan. And basically what they do is they celebrate Lee Harvey Oswald's birthday, but they want to focus on him as the scapegoat, as the fall man in the JFK assassination. And there's a great body of evidence today that would back up that assertion and that opinion that they express. There's a wide number of differing kinds of speakers. Sean Stone was there by chance, and then Roger Stone was there. Barr McClellan was there. I mean, you'd have to go to this site. If you go to OswaldConference.com, you'll see the speakers that were there. And I believe that Chris Milligan is going to make available in the near future a DVD of all of those speakers. And so for a small remuneration, you should be able to order that from Trine Day there. I met Julia Cox. She's a right-hand lady of Chris Milligan. Boy, she's a fine lady. She's a stand-up lady, and she stands up for truth just like we do. But anyway, I spent the last weekend down there, the Saturday and Sunday, 500 miles down, 500 miles back. We left here about midnight on Friday night, last Friday, and then we drove all night long, and it took us 8 hours. At about 7:30 or 8, we were down there in at that Crown Plaza, and we walked in. It was real interesting. Chris knew I was coming. He didn't know exactly when I might arrive. I walk into the conference ballroom there, and it was set up for the conferees or something. And he said, "How you doing?" I said, "Fine." I said, "What do you need?" And he turned around to his AV man, audio, video, visual guy. He said, "What do you need?" And he ticked off a list. I said, "We'll get it. We got it for you out in the car, out in the van." Randall and I went out there and came back in and gave his AV man exactly what he needed. So it helped. It helped especially the equipment that we did provide. There were additional cables. There were additional microphones and things like that primarily. But it did give them that added little equipment boost that they needed to pull off, especially the panel discussions. This JFK thing next month in Dallas will be another conference, jfkconference.com. I don't think Chris is involved in that this year, but I believe Judith Berry Baker and Lorian Fenton, I think, are producing that in Dallas this coming month. I think it's 18th, 19th, and 20th, but check in to that. Go to the jfkconference.com, and you'll be able to get more information about that. They're inviting some of the same speakers that the Oswald Conference had, plus some additional ones. I think they'll have about 30-plus speakers up there. So you're going to get just an overwhelming number of speakers, good speakers. One of the panel discussions that Chris had at the Oswald Conference, getting back to that, is there was the forensic panel discussion. There were five men that actually received JFK's body at Bethesda, Maryland, that night when it was flown out of Dallas, the body was. And so they were called in to duty there at the hospital and actually received the body and got the first looks at it. They said the brain was missing, but there was definite evidence of frontal shots to the forehead. So that disproved totally this Lee Harvey Oswald was a single shooter and all that. There were multiple shooters around Dealey Plaza that day. And I think Jim Mars wrote a book called Crossfire. Charlotte Littlefield Brown and I were up there one time. She was traveling back from leaving her children up in Missouri one year. And I told her, I said, "Hey, Charlotte, won't you drop into the Texas School Book Depository and see if we can get in a four-hour interview up there, a broadcast, radio broadcast, from inside the lobby there." And so she dropped by and made friends with the director of the center there. They have a museum, the Texas School Book Depository Museum. They have a sniper's nest up there. And then they have a little library in there for the public. And there's a lot of tourists that come through there. They want to see, this sniper's nest where Lee Harvey Oswald shot, the brains out of JFK from the rear. And they were shooting from the front too, So anyway, we went up there and did a four-hour program. And we had some friends here running. I think it was on my program, World Review Commentary. And we expanded that. Normally that's a two-hour program. And I had special plans, and we expanded it to 4 hours. Anyway, we went in there and set up inside the lobby of the Texas School Book Depository. And I think we had Alan Watt on the first hour. But what happened on that was we played the 17-minute speech that JFK gave at the Waldorf Astoria to a newspaper publishing group. And in that speech, it's so insightful. He even talks about Karl Marx, who was writing for that new Greeley's newspaper there in New York for a while. And he said something about if we'd paid him more, maybe he wouldn't have caused all this trouble for us, you know. In other words, Greeley paid him, I think, $5 an edition or something for his writings. And JFK had a wonderful sense of humor. But anyway, we let off on that four-hour broadcast with a 17-minute speech. And he got into the secret societies and all that stuff. So he was no friend of the secret societies or the that bunch, say, mystery school bunch, you could say. So anyway, then we followed with Alan Watt, and then we had an hour or two of freelance taking calls. And then our final hour, John Judge came in. He used to head up the other group that used to have an annual, conference up there. But he passed away now. But anyway, they wouldn't let him come in because he said, well, you didn't have that worked out with us. By then, they knew we were on the conspiratorial side. They didn't want us there at all, period. So I had John on the phone. I said, just call into this number. And they passed him through to us there live. So we had John Judge talk about many of the aspects. And he was considered an expert on the JFK thing. They had been exposing all these assassinations of some of our national leaders for years. And it was JFK, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and I think it was Malcolm X or the four that they concentrated on, his group did. But we had that interview, and that went fairly well. Before that, Charlotte and I had gone up and looked at the sniper's nest, and that's just a real put-up job, just part of the cover-up that's going on. Then I went out and looked, got behind the picket fence. And the picket fence is very, very close up to the back of let me put this way. Elm Street comes down and to the south after you make that final corner that the JFK limousine did. And then it goes downhill right there. But as it's going downhill, the picket fence isn't 55 to 65 feet from where the shots occurred that killed our president. So it's very close up. It's closer up than it appears. When you look at it on film and so forth, it looks like it's a lot further. The green knoll, grassy knoll, you could say, looks like it's bigger and than it really is. It's really compressed more because as that street comes down there, it gets closer to that picket fence as it goes downhill and curves slightly to the left. Then it goes underneath the railroad track. But I've been up there behind the picket fence. I did some video for John B. Wells and gave it to him last year I was up there. And so we've been out there on the train overpass trestle. And the shots were just excellent vantage point shots directly down into that limousine from three or four different locations there. So there was definitely a crossfire. And even some of the buildings behind the Dow Tax building, we think, there were shots that came from there and so forth. And so it was when he went around the corner, he had to slow down. And as he comes around there and straightens out and goes downhill, the front windshield gets lower than the back seat. And so shots from the front were feasible also, directly from the front. But there was a shot through the windshield, according to one patrolman that has testified over the years at some of the JFK conferences held in Dallas. This year, the conference up there will be a few days before the 22nd, because the 22nd, I think, falls on a Tuesday, maybe. So it's like 18th, 19th, 20th, or something like that. And then it'll be Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So check out the JFKconference.com, and it's a reasonable price to get in for the full 3 days. It's like Friday, and then all day Saturday, and all day Sunday. So it's really a bargain if you're interested in this. There'll be book vendors there surrounding or out in the lobby or surrounding on the outside walls there selling their books. So you'll be able to meet these authors and bend their ear and get some talk with some of the authors, personally meet some of these fine authors, and you can go from there. But anyway, I'm going to make some comments here. And then come back, and I'm going to set up my little 10-minute interview that I had with Roger. But thank you for listening. And now is the speech that Roger Stone gave at the Oswald Conference. Thank you for listening.
To the Subcommittee of Defense Appropriations, which was technically an aerospace subcommittee, where the Central Intelligence Agency's secret black box budgets are parked. In other words, LBJ is the paymaster for the CIA. And he's on that committee. He continues on that committee after he becomes majority leader. It's a rarity. And when he leaves to become vice president, he inserts Senator Harry F. Byrd of Virginia, whose first cousin, D.H. Byrd, happens to own the Texas School Depository Building. What an extraordinary coincidence. And of course, Senator Byrd is a loyal legislative lieutenant to Lyndon Johnson. So Johnson's control of the Central Intelligence Agency budget continues into his vice presidency through the legislative branch. We know that that Lyndon Johnson was taking bribes from Carlos Marcello, passed through Jack Halford, to protect the mob's illegal gambling operations in Dallas and Houston and San Antonio. And we know, of course, about his relationship with Big Texas Oil. John Kennedy has enraged the oil men because he's talked about and he's proposed repealing the oil depletion allowance, which means they will spend hundreds of millions of dollars more in taxes. So I make the case, motive means opportunity, eyewitness evidence, fingerprint evidence. All of this brings you to Lyndon Johnson as a linchpin in the plot to kill Kennedy. That doesn't mean the agency wasn't involved. They're involved up to their hips. So is the mob. So is Big Texas Oil. But I argue to you that it's Johnson who controls the local investigation. Remember, in 1963, murder is not a federal crime. Murder of a federal official is not yet a federal crime. Murder is a state crime. And therefore, the jurisdiction belongs to the district attorney. The DA, within hours of Kennedy's assassination, has a press conference, announces that there was a plot, we're going to round up everybody. And then he gets a call from one of Johnson's aides, he holds a new press conference, he says, there was no plot, it was one guy, and we got it. Like overnight, wow. And of course, Police Chief Jerry Curry never leaves Lyndon Johnson's sight from the minute Kennedy is shot. In fact, he actually rides back on Air Force One to Andrews Air Force Base, where the first guy bounding up the steps to give Johnson an enormous bear hug is the director of the Secret Service, Mr. Rowe. Small world. He got his first job from Lyndon Johnson in Roosevelt's youth administration. He's also a protege and former FBI man, protege of J. Edgar Hoover. Now, others are more eloquent on the Secret Service failures on November 22nd, 1963, but some of them are elementary. And it's interesting that the protocols that are involved in the travel of the president, which are observed in Miami and Chicago, are not observed in Dallas. The buildings on both sides of the street are supposed to be searched and sealed. They aren't. There's supposed to be 6 motorcycle policemen. There are 2. There's supposed to be agents on either side of the rear axle when the car drops below a certain mile per hour. They're not. There's supposed to be agents on the back bumper. There are not. There's supposed to be agents planted throughout the crowd, plain clothes. There are not. So it is impossible to believe that the murder of Kennedy could have happened without the complicity of the Secret Service. Virtually impossible to believe that. This is one of many of the anomalies that I examine in my book. My next book was on Watergate and Richard Nixon. Now, I had a close association with President Nixon. I got to know him extremely well in his post-presidential years. I worked for him in a number of capacities, both before and after his resignation. My book on Nixon would not have been possible without the assistance of Len Kaladny, who's here with us today, and whose book, Silent Coup, has to be read prior to reading my book on Nixon because they're bookends. We helped fill in a lot of the gaps. And I know he had a presentation here, and I've heard him speak before. He has exposed the entire myth of the Woodward, Bernstein, Washington Post,
fairy tale.
I was going to say something night worse, but fairy tale regarding Watergate. You see, Nixon, and I'm not to say that Nixon was in any way a saint. I don't say that. He was both very great and very flawed. But here's what they didn't expect him to be. A peacemaker. Because he ended the war in Vietnam on a much faster timetable than the Joint Chiefs want. He reached a SALT agreement with the Russians, which the Joint Chiefs were opposed to. He opened the door to China, and he exacerbated that by negotiating the whole thing around the diplomatic and intelligence corps, so they learned about it only after the deal was cut. That made them even angrier. Yes, peacemaker. They expected him to be the ultimate hawk. They expected carte blanche in Vietnam, which, when you look at the number of bombs Johnson dropped, you gotta wonder what they wanted. So, yes, Nixon, he sowed the seeds of his own destruction through his own paranoia. But as I say, he ended the war in Vietnam. He opened the door to China. He reached an strategic arms limitation agreement with the Soviets. He single-handedly saved Israel from annihilation in the 1973 Yom Kippur War. Over the objections of Kissinger, over the objections of the Joint Chiefs, when the Israelis have their backs against the sea after a surprise attack by Egypt and Syria, it's Richard Nixon, the same Richard Nixon who said disparaging things about Jews in the White Watergate tapes. It's Richard Nixon who saves Israel. You don't believe me? Ask Golda Meir. She said he desegregated the public schools without violence. When he became president, roughly 20% of the public schools were desegregated. That number was near 90 at the time he left. He gave us federal revenue sharing so that federal money could best be spent at the local level by local decision makers. He desegregated the trade unions. He gave us our first elementary environmental protection through the EPA. Now, I understand that agency's gone crazy today, but in 1970, we had no environmental protection. I'm sorry. There are people who are so greedy, so anxious to make a profit, they will ruin our water and our air to do so. Now, you can go too far. We've done that today where you can't build anything. But the Environmental Protection Agency, as it was originally conceived, was an accomplishment. Now, compare that to accomplishments of our current president. Those would be, okay, we'll move on. In any event, this brings me to the Clinton's War on Women. This is the book that should have been utilized by the Trump campaign earlier than it has been. I want to be very clear because there's an enormous amount of media misdirection. I am completely uninterested in marital infidelity, or indiscretions, or girlfriends, or mistresses, or one-night stands by Bill Clinton. If I wrote such a book, it would have to be an encyclopedia. The man's an addict. But rape and sexual assault and exposing yourself in an aroused state and biting women, which is his M.O. because he bit Juanita Roderick through the upper lip, bit her so badly that she had to go to the hospital. Her upper lip was turning black. He bit two other women, one identified by Mike Isikoff of NBC, now I think then with Newsweek, and also one identified by Roger Morris, then of the Washington Post. So those are hardly all conservative outlets. No, he's a sexual predator. Now the liberals say, well, but he's not running for president. No, but Hillary Clinton is an accessory after the fact in every one of those sex crimes because she knows about them and she runs the cover-up. She's the one who hires the heavy-handed private detectives and the nasty lawyers to dig dirt on these women, to discredit them, to bully them, to threaten them, either into silence or into not answering the subpoena. And James Carville says, these women are trailer trash. Let me get this straight, James. It's okay to rape a poor woman? Is that what you're saying? That's the worst elitist crap I've ever heard in my life. And he's viewed as some great genius for saying that. It's insulting. It's typical of the elitism that surrounds the Clintons. Bill Clinton's first rape is at Oxford. He's expelled from Oxford. The idea that he left Oxford to go to Yale Law School is a joke. No one drops out of the Rhodes Scholar Program. Those who didn't complete the program, about 1%, that's because they died. No, Eileen Wellstone is the name of the 19-year-old that he raped. And then Senator William Fulbright of Arkansas pulled strings to cover that rape up. Now, my book is about far more than the sexual exploits of Bill Clinton and the cover-up operation by his wife. But you cannot run for president as an advocate for women if you are, in fact, an abuser of women. Hillary says she's an advocate for children. What about Kathy Shelton? Kathy Shelton was 12 years old when she was so brutally raped by two men that she was in a coma for 5 days. She was so viciously raped that she can never bear children. One of the men escapes and is never identified. The other man, 41 years old, well, he gets a very fine lawyer appointed by the judge, who happens to be a crony of the Clintons. He appoints Hillary Rodham Clinton as this rapist's attorney. And Mrs. Clinton bullies a 12-year-old on the stand and says to her, you fantasized about sex with older men, haven't you? You wanted somebody older, didn't you? You made false allegations of being assaulted sexually by older men in the past. Every one of those things is a lie without any foundation whatsoever. And then she gets the judge to agree, since the hospital records and the police records in this case are conveniently missing, gone, lost by the county. They said it was a flood. They lost them in a flood. She gets the judge to agree that the forensic examination of the 12-year-old woman's underwear should be limited to a small piece of cloth that's cut out of the underwear instead of the entire garment. Suppression of evidence. Now, you could argue that under our American system, every person charged with a crime is entitled to an attorney, and that's right. But here's the problem. We have on tape Hillary Clinton after the trial laughing about his guilt, saying she knew he was guilty and she was happy that she got him off with time served, 2 months. They ruined the life of a little girl. And she got him off with 2 months time served. Does that sound like an advocate for children to you? Now, every woman in this country needs to know about that case in the next 23 days. I was delighted to see Kathy Shelton surface at the debate. I know she's going to be speaking out. The Clintonites can't say, oh, that's about Bill. Well, that's not about Bill. That's about Hillary. Hillary, the advocate for children. Hillary, the one who gave the go order at Waco that killed 18 children under the age of 8. Yes, co-president Hillary gave the order to her hand-selected deputy attorney general, Webster Hubbell, Chelsea's father, that Webster Hubbell. and Jan Reno, the other hand-picked stooge of Hillary Clinton. It was Hillary who wanted Waco over because she didn't want it to distract from her upcoming health care extravaganza. Now, lastly, we heard some discussion, and she keeps calling Donald Trump a racist. This is really getting old. Yet, Bill Clinton is the one who has an abandoned black son, Danny Williams, run off by Hillary. Now, the Washington Post and the LA Times and the Associated Press reported that a DNA test that was conducted in 1999 disproved that. And now you have mummy dummies like Megyn Kelly and others repeating that. So I dug into it. And here's what I learned. The Star tabloid obtained no DNA sample from Bill Clinton. What they did was get the written report on his DNA that was included in Ken Starr's impeachment report. The problem with that is that in order to legally determine paternity, there are two different tests that must be conducted and then compared. One of those tests is insufficient. It's not enough data. Yet when you go to the Starr impeachment report, what you really have is half a report on Bill's DNA. You only have one of the two tests missing on the results of the second test. Slate Magazine, hardly a publication of the right. Snopes.com, hardly a publication of the right. Dr. Henry Lee, one of the leading pathologists in the country, have all written that any test utilizing only that sample would have to be inconclusive. It could prove nothing. Yet the Star announces that the test that they conducted shows that Danny Williams is not the son of Bill Clinton. It didn't show that at all. It didn't show that he was, and it didn't show that he wasn't. It was inconclusive. But that didn't stop the Post and the LA Times and the others from misreporting it. Now here's the kicker. Who owned the Star? A man named Robert Altman, Bill's college roommate at Georgetown, Undersecretary of the Treasury in the Clinton administration, a man who had to step down from that position because he got caught giving the Clintons a heads up in Whitewater. This was a classic setup. The Star never ran the story, but they did put out a press release and they did conduct interviews by their editor who said, "We didn't publish the story because the test showed that Bill was not Danny's father." It showed nothing of the kind, and I think his name was Phil Button, was the editor, admitted that he'd never actually seen a written test result. Well, that's because there probably never was one, or if there was, whoever conducted it knew in advance that it had to be inconclusive. Now, if you go online and you see video of Danny Williams, he looks just like his father. What are the arguments for him? Very simply, his mother was a cocaine-addicted prostitute. She was with Bill Clinton on 13 occasions for paid sex. She described the exact floor plan of the cabin that was owned by Bill's mother where they would go for sexual trysts, and she passed a polygraph, not once, but twice, 10 years apart. She and her sister, Lucille Bolton, and her sister, Shirley, all say that at the beginning of every month, a man driving a state vehicle with Arkansas state tags would put an envelope in the mailbox with seven crisp $100 bills. And they also say that an Arkansas state trooper would deliver Christmas presents to the home where Danny and his mother lived every Christmas. Now, Larry Patterson confirms that in his book. He was an Arkansas trooper and one of those who delivered the presents. L.D. Brown, another Arkansas trooper, confirms it in his book. He also delivered some of these Christmas presents. In 1999, Lucille Bolton, who's Danny's aunt, who is a deacon in her church for 30 years, who has worked in the same public school cafeteria for 30 years, who is an upright member of her community, she took the infant, Danny, to the governor's mansion. She waited outside the gate, and when the gates opened to let a car out, she ran inside the compound. She got as far as the front door. She knocked on the door. She demanded to see Hillary Clinton. They said, about what? They said, this here is Bill Clinton's son. It's time you take care of him. They slammed the door in her face, and she put it to me in an interview, they run us off like dogs. So he's not just Bill's abandoned son. He's Bill's abandoned son banished by Hillary. In other words, Black Lives Matter unless you're Bill Clinton's son. It takes a village. Are you going to lecture us about a village? You don't even take care of your own. That's racism. There's the racism. Danny Williams has a couple alternatives. Now that the DNA test that was fraudulently taken in 1999 has been debunked, he can ask his famous father to do the right thing, because a boy needs his father. He's got five kids of his own, and he struggles to put food on the table. He works a construction job by day, works at a 7-Eleven at night to feed the hungry mouths of his family. His parent, his stepmother, and his father are worth upwards of $300 million. He can do three things. He has asked Bill for a voluntary DNA sample to resolve this. If Hillary really thinks that Black Lives Matter, she shouldn't stand in the way. Secondarily, he could go to Monica Lewinsky and get a verified and complete DNA sample to compare with his own DNA. Whether or not she would cooperate, that remains to be seen. If she still owns the dress. She was in custody of the dress. She turned down a multi-million-dollar offer to buy it several years ago, but that's a second possibility. And then there's the third possibility. In a paternity suit, most of the time, a judge will order a simple DNA test to settle the matter of paternity. Now, in Watergate, the lesson of Watergate, unless I get this wrong, was no one is above the law. Wasn't that what they told us? Well, according to the FBI director, Hillary's above the law because she egregiously and repeatedly broke the law and lied about it and has paid no penalty. You see, the FBI is too busy investigating Roger Stone. Whether a judge would order a simple black man who's 30 years old from Arkansas, whether he would order a DNA test, that remains to be seen. But I do know that the friends of Danny Williams are going to be founding a GoFundMe to raise the money for first-rate legal representation in a paternity suit. Now, this question may not get answered in the next 23 days, but it will get answered. Because, you see, to me, black lives do matter. All lives matter. Thank you very much.
Hello. Yeah, welcome back. I hope you enjoyed that speech of Roger Stone. We didn't play the question and answers part of it, but he starts off with LBJ being on one of the most powerful committees in Congress. And actually, he was on the committee that paid the CIA and other clandestine operations and CIA and so forth, NSA. So that's why it was a very, very powerful committee that he was head of. Anyway, what's coming up next is the 10-minute interview that I had with Roger Stone, and we did it in the lobby out there of the during the Oswald conference. And I asked him, I asked him about the John Podesta article. We have that up on thesecrettruth.com now, so you can read the actual article. And then we discussed that a little bit. Then we got into the Trump campaign. And also, he said that people were following him. And so there, he's in a very, very dangerous position here at times. So I'm going to make a few more comments after you listen to this 10-minute interview, and then we'll go from there. But thank you for listening. I hope you enjoy this small, short interview I had with Roger Stone. That's coming up next right now. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to the Oswald Conference in New Orleans 2016. And sitting next to me, my gosh, I can't say any greater things than Roger Stone is with me, and he's recently written an article, John Podesta, and I think this raises him above most journalists in this country, if not worldly journalists. He really knocked them dead in that article, and the depth of the article so impressed me that I just couldn't get over it. How did you get the knowledge and the insight into achieve an article written about John Podesta like you did?
Well, I'm a researcher. I have contacts across Europe. I had a large number of documents regarding his business dealings, which came to me in both Russian and German, that had to be translated. Let me say for the record, I received nothing from WikiLeaks, nothing. But this attack on me now by Podesta and the Clintonites is an attempt to deflect away from their criminality. Between my article and the WikiLeaks disclosures, it's very clear John Podesta has been money laundering for the Russian mob and the Clinton Foundation. Also believe that he's money laundering in connection with military technology transfers to this country. I suspect that there's far, far more coming regarding both Podesta and others in the Clinton crime cabal. But back in August, when I said on Twitter that there would be, I think the way I put it was, it will soon be John Podesta's time in the barrel, I was referring to my own research and my own article, nothing that came to me through WikiLeaks. And anybody who says otherwise is lying.
Roger, how are you holding up under this vicious attack mounted by the opposition? And they're really criminal. There's a big criminal opposition against you. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think they spend millions of dollars to try to discredit me on social media. I'm clearly being followed. They are, there are harassment of my children, harassment of my wife. These are the thug tactics of the Clintons. They're really more like the mafia than not. But I'm holding up fine. I remember that great line that George C. Scott said when he was portraying George Patton in the movie Patton. He's looking out across the battlefield and he says, "God, I love war." See, this is political combat. We're fighting for the future of our country. And therefore, I find every day exciting and exhilarating, and I'm just happy to be in the fight for what I believe in.
You know, I've been with you at these conferences, and I've done production and video primarily, but you really have a deep commitment to this country. That for sure. And I can attest to that. And because you show up and you say it like it is. You don't hold back.
Thank you.
You go 100% because you care about our freedoms and liberties. Where today, in this battle between, and it is a war, is it not?
It is.
Between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Where are we right now in possibly winning this race, or what's your assessment right now?
I think the election's still up for grabs. I think that we have a very volatile electorate. I think we have two candidates that are exceedingly polarizing. I think there's greater intensity among Trump's supporters than there is among Hillary's supporters. I think many professional Democrats are for Hillary because they feel they must be, not because they like her or that they're anxious to see the return of she and her husband. The next debate could be pivotal. But as you probably know, I've also written extensively about the possibility of this election being stolen. These computerized voting machines are easily hacked and rigged. We have a Princeton professor telling this. We have a study out of Stanford telling this. We have a study out of Ohio State telling us this. There's a lot of evidence that the machines were rigged against Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primaries. So I have a very real concern. Now, it's a mistake to confuse voter fraud and election theft. These are two different things, although they're interrelated. Voter fraud is when people who aren't eligible to vote vote, people who vote multiple times, people who vote in different states on the same day, people who vote in the name of another who may be deceased or may be not voting. That's voter fraud. Barack Obama says it doesn't exist, but then in the next breath he says we're going to bring in the UN to monitor for voter fraud. So which is it? It either doesn't exist or it does. And then there's election theft. That's the rigging of the machines through computer programming for a predetermined result. And I would note that the precursor to this is manipulation of the polls, so that the polls show a result that matches the result of the machines, so they set the public expectation level, and then nobody is the wiser. The way I hope to try to combat this is by conducting a national exit poll in certain precincts, certain counties, certain states where I suspect theft will go on. Exit polls of people actually leaving the polling places are the most accurate polls because we have found that people's memory becomes colored by the results of the election, but they don't yet know the results of the election. And therefore, the tendency to gravitate towards the winner and say, oh, I voted for the winner, doesn't play any factor.
Could this be a first time in history where both parties collude together to deny Donald Trump victory? Because there's that faction in the Republican Party that's right in there with the Democrats that don't want Trump in the White House.
Very definitely. I think Trump is challenging the two-party duopoly. The Republican organization in Ohio is working actively against him. The Republican organization in Florida is working actively against him. In truth, the Republican National Committee is working actively against him, all the while giving him lip service. So, yes, you may have the collusion of the two-party elites to defeat Donald Trump because, after all, he disrupts business as usual. Most of the leaders of the Republican Party wear the second hat of lobbyists. Many of them are lobbyists for the corporate interests and the multinational corporate interests. And therefore, I think there is there's a real danger of the two parties colluding to stop
Could there
Trump.
Be a closet Trump vote? This is not unpredictable. I think there's been recent evidence to indicate there may be the solid majority for Trump, very conservative people, and they're from the worker class, many of them, and from labor even. He's reaching out over traditional voting blocks, is he not?
He is. One of the things that we have noticed is that when a poll of voters is automated, telephone poll, and you're essentially talking to a computer, you know, it says, for Donald Trump, push 1. To vote for Hillary Clinton, vote 2. You're undecided, put 3, and so on. And then you compare those to polls that are conducted with a live operator. Trump runs 3 to 5% better in the automated polls, meaning voters don't want to tell a stranger on the phone that they're voting for Donald Trump. They don't want people to know. They don't want to be harassed.
Right. There's been several instances of harassment or violence.
So I think that yes.
Absolutely right.
I think there may indeed be a hidden vote.
What would be your final conclusions today? I know you're pressed for other engagements and so forth. But what would be your concluding remarks today after speaking to this group? And they were enthusiastic. You, Roger, you stood up like a man, and you said it like a man. and so forth, and I really admire you for that. What would be your concluding remarks today about being here and so forth?
It's all up for grabs in the next 23 days. We have a unique opportunity to elect a president who is not a globalist, who is not part and parcel of the last 30 years of failed policies, who is not a neocon who wants to rush this country to war, who's not an interventionist who goes around the globe looking for trouble. We have a guy who could actually balance the books, who could run government like he's run his business, where he, believe me, he knows where every dollar is. Somebody who has executive experience, somebody who actually gets things done, doesn't just talk about them, but does them, and achieves his goals. Somebody with confidence. I haven't seen this kind of self-confidence and this kind of love of country since Ronald Reagan. And he reminds me in many ways of Reagan. Remember what they said about Reagan? Oh, he's too simple to be president. He's too radical. He's not involved enough in the details. Still one of the greatest presidents in my lifetime. So it's all up for grabs now. Those of faint heart who think this election's lost, you know, don't be a sunshine patriot. This is still 100% winnable, and the next 23 days will be pivotal. I will be out there on the ramparts. Come out and join me.
Okay, thank you very much, Roger Stone, and your marvelous person, nice person.
Welcome back to the program. I hope you're enjoying this second hour. Mainly, we had the focus. Our focus was on Roger Stone. He's written some really fine books. They're in-depth. They're insightful. And you can go to his Amazon. They're all on Amazon. He's trying to make a concerted effort to try to save this election for Trump. He feels very strongly that Hillary and her campaign are going to cheat the election. And this recent information by James O'Keefe would support that conclusion or that opinion. So he's out there doing the utmost that he can to uncover as much of the corruption and so forth that that her campaign has been guilty of. This recent information is very, very explosive and very damaging to Hillary. It's amazing, though, that you go to these rallies or whatever, and you watch some of these people that are supporting Hillary, and they have sort of a glazed over look. Oprah Winfrey recently said, "You don't have to like her to vote for her." Now, what is that coming? Where is that coming from? You know, I expressed the opinion that I said, "Well, Oprah's not very smart." He said, "No, but she is, because she's in line with the big money." See, when you look at Hillary, Hillary's got Wall Street and all the big investment and the Europeans and the Bilderberg Group and the Kissingers and all those people, all those insiders are solidly behind their support for Hillary Clinton. She's been at this for 30 years in politics, coming in out of Arkansas. So she and Bill have built up a lot of friendships, and it's all about big money. See, the Clinton Foundation is about money. There's all kinds of emails that are coming out now where Chelsea is saying, "Oh well, should we do this or not?" And so even Chelsea's beginning to understand what's really going on in that campaign and some of the problems that they've had in violations of foundation laws. I mean, the other night, the last debate, Hillary made the statement that 90% of the Clinton Foundation funds were given away to charity. Well, I think that would be a very, very difficult fact to prove. And if she really believes that, or if that's a truthful statement, then she ought to open up the books to the Clinton Foundation. A cursory review of some of the transactions of the Clinton Foundation would not prove anything close to that. And some are alleging or asserting that of the monies collected for Haiti, only 5% of it got to the Haitians. Now, you have people in Haiti on the ground. Gary Havens is a multi-billionaire, and he's on the ground with four airplanes on the ground in Haiti on the western end there where the damage from the hurricane was the greatest. And he's flying crippled people out of there, people with broken bones, and he's saving a lot of lives. And so where is the Clinton Foundation? And he said that Americans came in there, American military, for a short period of time and then left. There are UN helicopters flying around and so forth, but there's nobody out there where he's at, where he's had to fly in to fly in supplies and food. He's feeding people every day. He's saving lives. So, and Haven's quite a Christian. And what he says about Hillary on interviews is just really... it's really eye-opening, his opinion. And his opinion I would value and respect greatly. So we're looking at a race coming up on November 8th. We're coming up with people that have predispositions for Hillary. They think that all these videos that James O'Keefe are doing are bad, or he should have done this. But with the actors there that are working for her, and it's proven that they're working not directly for her campaign, but have been hired on, see, to do certain jobs. I mean, that's proven already. And since they were hired on to do certain jobs, then it's they've admitted that. And there are these videos, and they're very damaging. So, but you have a lot of people on both sides that will ignore anything derogatory or negative about their particular candidate, see. And so that goes on and on and on. And we all have our predispositions to who we like, or we're either Republicans or Democrats or so forth. I said earlier in this broadcast that, yeah, it appears, according to Greg Palast, that George W. cheated Al Gore out of in Florida. He had his brother in the office there as governor. And so that's what Greg Palast says with his in-depth reporting and so forth over the years. And I've interviewed him, Charlotte, and I've interviewed Greg Palast probably 3 to 4 times, I think. And this subject has come up almost every time. But Greg Palast is quite a reporter out of New York. The best government money can buy, I think, is one of his publications. But he does have some pretty accurate information out there. We want to thank everybody for listening out there. We broadcast every Saturday night here in Austin, 89.1 FM. Our website is thesecrettruth.com. TheSecretTruth.com. We're also on Facebook under the same name, Secret Truth Show. And we're also on Twitter under the same Secret Truth Show also. We put these programs up on Facebook, and we also go out on Twitter to reach the maximum number of viewers and so forth. We're pretty widely accepted across the web. We don't know all of the retweets or all of the hypertext links that people are doing to link into us. But we have been established for 10 years, and we believe in what we're doing. We don't lie about things. We don't insult people. We don't name call. Charlotte has never name called anybody, and I never have either. We just won't do it. We're not going to name call people. We're going to try to deal on the issues. And that's far more important than anything anyway. Because if you can deal with the issues and you can show what the issues are all about, that's important. Thank you for listening, and good night. Thank you.